One of the most penetrating questions in the Christian community is WWJD. WWJD. Does anybody know what that stands for? What would Jesus do? Yes. And that's a penetrating question, to say the least. But if Christ never existed, I think WWJD could still be used to make Christians think. WWJD in what would Joseph do? What would Joseph do? Joseph, mentioned in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, Joseph, the multifaceted man that had many talents, who was undaunted by obstacles, refused to be discouraged, was able to turn lemons into lemonade, so to speak. I think one of the drawbacks with the concept of doing a sermon on the book of, or the story of Joseph, is that for most of us, it may remain too superficial in our lives, not intentionally, but inadvertently, because it may be something that we're familiar with, but the depth of that story, the depth of what happened, to me is profound, and there are some wonderful, absolutely marvelous lessons and examples for us to follow from it that we can gain. I mean, he is an absolute marvel. And if we can handle our challenges as Joseph handled his, there's no doubt that we can multiply our ability to serve God as well as be blessed by God. The title of this sermon is Up From Ashes. Up From Ashes. Overlooked reasons why Joseph was so successful with God and man. And he certainly was. There have been other people. Christ certainly grew in stature and favor with God and man. That's over in Luke 2:51. And then 1 Samuel 2:26, Samuel also, who became high priest, growing up. He knew how to get along with people, and he certainly had a relationship with God. But Joseph certainly was among them. He was outstanding, almost flawless in his ability to help people and work with people and be innovative and see ideas and have vision, see the possibilities. I mean, we know, and we've speculated over the last number of years, that in the world tomorrow, in the millennium, that Joseph will have an important position and perhaps be in charge of the economy of the world. I mean, that's a calculated guess, but we're absolutely sure that he'll be a prominent leader because of the abilities that he demonstrated, in the fact that he was one that multiplied his talents. He never settled for where he was. I mean, he was complacent with his relationship with God, but he knew that he could be productive, and it was his nature to help and to expand and to develop. And he not only developed himself, but everyone around him. He was an absolute marvel. Again, if we handle our challenges as Joseph handled his, we will multiply our ability to serve God as well as increase our ability to be blessed by God. And who doesn't want that? At any age, anywhere, at any time. And I also marvel at the fact that virtually flawlessly, Joseph combined faith and works together. You know, it's important, faith and works. Over in the book of James, it talks about the fact that if we have faith but we don't do any works, faith without works is dead. By that, I mean, we can believe all we want, but if we don't make specific efforts in our lives, we won't get that far. The opposite's true. If we believe in works and works, and we don't make room for God in our lives, then we're incomplete. So works without faith is dead. Faith without works is dead. They go together. So even when Joseph had trust in God, he also knew that there were responsible things that he himself could be doing. And we'll see some of that. There is one exception, though, and that is in his very early teen years, Joseph was naive. And he paid a price for that. It was a rude awakening. But back in chapter 37, we pick up the story where he was born and lived with a large family, and one that was quite dysfunctional. It was dysfunctional in the fact that Jacob was married to four women at the same time. Not a good recipe for happiness. Not at all. And a number of the children from those marriages were tenuous at best. A lot of sibling rivalry. It wasn't all against Joseph, but certainly it was by the time we read this account. I read from the same translation as our sermonette man, simply because it reads well, I think. But if this were a doctrinal sermon, I would want to use King James or something that's maybe most strictly capturing the sense of the Greek and the Hebrew. In chapter 37, in verse 2, and this is the account of Jacob and his family. When Joseph was 17 years old, he often tended his father's flock. He worked for his half-brothers, the sons of his father's wives, Bilhah and Zilpah. But Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things that the brothers were doing. Not a good idea if you want to ingratiate yourself to the rest of the family. They felt that he was a tattletale. But he was doing what his father had asked. In verse 3, Jacob made a terrible mistake here. He loved Joseph more than any of his other children because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. Now, I can't fault him for having a great deal of affection for Joseph, but if you start to show favoritism and it's blatant in front of the other family members, that just usually doesn't go over very well. And a thing that separated Joseph from the other brothers was that Joseph was born in Jacob's older age, when he was in a time when he was wealthy and he didn't have to work anymore, and he could spend his time giving guidance, instruction about God and about other things to Joseph, which he did. He didn't have that time for the others, not in the same way. Joseph was much younger. And one day Jacob made a special gift for Joseph, a beautiful robe, a coat of many colors. And his brothers hated Joseph because their father loved him more than the rest of them. They could not say a kind word to him. Verse 5, one night Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers about it, they hated him all the more. But he didn't catch it. He didn't read their body language. And just being naive, you know, going where angels would fear to tread, he's talking to these burly guys. He says, listen to this dream. We were out in a field tidying up bundles of grain, and suddenly my bundle stood up and your bundles gathered all around and bowed low before mine. His brothers responded, so you think you'll be our king, do you? You think you'll actually reign over us, huh? And they hated him all the more because of his dreams and the way he talked about them. Soon Joseph had another dream. And again he told his brothers about it. Why, he should have stopped and put the brakes on. No, I better not do that. They always get angry with me when I do that. But he said, listen, I had another dream. The sun, the moon, the 11 stars bowed low before me. This time he told the dream to his father as well as his brothers, and his father scolded him. What kind of a dream is that? He asked. Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? But while his brothers were jealous of Joseph, his father pondered all that the dreams meant. And so to summarize some of this, the day came when the brothers were some considerable distance away from home, herding sheep, and Jacob wanted to find out what was happening, keep tabs on him, so he sent Joseph. And Joseph finally tracked them down in verse 18. But when Joseph's brothers saw Joseph coming, they recognized him in the distance, and as he approached, they made plans to kill him. I'm going to talk about dysfunction. Here comes the dreamer, they said. Come on, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns. Then we can tell our father a wild animal has eaten him. Then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. Well, that's horrible. And Joseph didn't realize the turmoil that he had created. And when Reuben heard of it, he had an idea that, well, they could put him in a cistern, then he could sneak back, rescue him later. So he was secretly planning to rescue Joseph. Now, verse 23, so when Joseph arrived, his brothers ripped off the beautiful robe or coat that he was wearing, and then they grabbed him, and they threw him into the cistern. Now, he probably was thinking, what is this? What are they doing? How can this happen? I'll pinch myself. Is this really happening? My brothers, I think they actually hate me. They're leaving me here. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And just as the brothers were sitting down to eat, now they felt comfortable with this. You talk about being detached from a concerned heart. They've thrown him into this pit, and he could maybe die of thirst, and they're going to sit down and have lunch. So very, very insensitive. And as they were doing that, so to sit down to eat, they looked up and saw a caravan of camels coming toward them in the distance. It was a large group of Ishmaelite traders taking a load of goods to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What do we gain by killing our brother? We'll just have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to the Ishmaelite traders. After all, he is our own flesh and blood." The others agreed, and so that's what they did. Again, Joseph was wondering, why? I can't believe this. Now they're taking me out of the pit. They're selling me to strangers, swarthy people. I could be abused. I could be left for dead. Are they going to work me as a slave until I drop? What's going to happen to me? And the Ishmaelites carried him on and took him all the way down into Egypt. And in verse 36, they arrived in Egypt where they sold Joseph to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And Potiphar was a captain in the palace guard. Probably would be the equivalent today of being in charge of the Secret Service that would protect the President of the United States. A very high responsibility. Huge amount of responsibility indeed. So Joseph was carried into Egypt. He had that experience would be enough to traumatize a lot of people. When that would be the classic case of abuse, would it not? To be almost put to death and almost left for dead, only at the last minute to be sold to strangers that didn't have your best interest at heart, to be carted away from your family, away from your father, away from anything that was good, away from security. There are people, and I've talked to many, that have said, let me tell you what happened to me, and this horrible thing happened, and I've never forgotten it. And some have said, and that negative experience was no fair. In fact, God must not be fair because this happened to me. Joseph did not think that way. There's no evidence of that. But most people would say, well, if he ever thought it or said it, I can totally relate to that because it was anything but fair. Sometimes, we can go through trials. We can go through experiences, and we can say it isn't fair. It's not fair. Not right. It's a challenge to my idealism. It's a challenge to what's right and wrong. It's impossible for this to happen, and yet it did happen. I can't believe it. I can't get over it. I can't forget it. It's eaten at me. And I've known people for 10, 20, 30 years that have harbored things. They're boiling under the surface. And they've got a lid on it. But it's like the French have said after World War II with the German invasion. Remember it often. Speak of it never. And that's not what God wants us to do with the baggage that we have maybe been experienced, have experienced in our histories. Sometimes that has to be counseled out, to be evaporated. We can't let these things eat us up. You know, we could allow 100 sunsets to go down on our wrath if we're not careful. And I'm not saying that's a big issue here, but I'm saying that is what can happen a lot of times if people go through the trauma, the emotional trauma that somebody like Joseph experienced. I'll never forget a sermon that was given by one pastor years ago. He gave it, and he talked about the time that he had cancer, and he thought it was a terrible, terrible trial. Well, people prayed about it. He got through it. And then he thought he was cancer-free for the rest of his life. And then, about 5 years later, he was shocked. He got a different type of cancer. And when he got the news at the oncologist office, he said, I walked outside. I just automatically did. I didn't even finish my conversation with the nurse. And I just wandered aimlessly several blocks away until I came to this park, and I sat down at this bench, and I decided to pray to God. And he says, it's not fair. It is not fair. Some people have cancer once. I had it twice. I've got it again. It's not right. He said, I also said some disrespectful things when I prayed, and then I later withdrew those comments and apologized. But a lot of people have said, it's not fair. My health condition, my unemployment, my rebellious car, it's not fair to have these things. And people have wrestled with betrayals and abandonment issues and any number of issues. And God has allowed these things. Joseph was undaunted by that, all indication is. Joseph was betrayed by his brothers. So if we ask WWJD, what would Joseph do? He stayed the course. He remained in relationship with God. We'll talk about that in a minute. Prior to that, I'd like to raise the penetrating question, what would you do? What would I do if we were both thrown into a pit and left for dead and then at the last minute sold into slavery? It would not be easy. It would not be, in fact, quite difficult. But Joseph had something going for him. What would he have that would encourage him to stay with God when all these horrible things unfolded? He had his dreams. His dreams. He believed in his dreams. And the dreams indicated that he would be in a prominent position. Well, he was in anything but prominent position in slavery, but he knew it wasn't going to end that way. You know what? We have our dreams too. Our dreams are the dreams of the prophets and others that write and have written in the Bible different prophecies for the future, the millennium, that talk about a time when we're going to be kings and priests. We're going to be in rulership with other people that God has called in an ever-expanding population of human beings on this earth. Revelation 5, verse 10 talks about that, and any number of other areas of the Bible. And there's a time when we're going to have a future that has so much responsibility, that's going to be so significant, that will make a difference for millions of other people as we help to rectify the problems of this world and to put the human race back on its feet after the Great Tribulation, the return of Christ. These are immutable, unchangeable promises the Bible gives, and they should be enough to carry us through the difficulties of the future. We can rest our eyes on that and be confident on that, and that's our vision, and that can keep us going, that we have great purpose to live for. It helps to get through some of the rough areas. Vision always does that. Joseph never lost it. He had many an hour to meditate on his mistakes. He shouldn't have been so naive with his brothers, should have seen the writing on the wall. But Joseph was a quick study. He analyzed things. He changed. And he not only believed in his dreams, he obviously had to continue to have a relationship with God, because we will see a number of times where it says, and the Lord was with Joseph. He was with him. That only happens when you have a cycle of communication. You're communicating with him and he's communicating with you. You pray to God, he answers through the pages of the Bible. And meaningful Bible study is when it speaks to us. When we can go in here and go through chapters or whatever, and we see things jump out at us that really comes to answer what's needful for us, that helps us in our time of wanting help, wanting guidance, wanting reassurance, whatever it is. So as we look through these things and say, well, I could now let me put myself in that. In his shoes. What would he do? What would I do? Sometimes the path to success is difficult because, in 2 Corinthians, it says, we walk by faith, not by sight. That's in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7. I'd like to turn to Hebrews 11, verse 6. Hebrews 11, verse 6, which is always true in our lives and absolutely essential if we want to maintain a meaningful relationship with God, a relationship by which we sooner or later get the results that we need and the blessings that we want. Hebrews 11, verse 6, "And it is impossible to please God without faith. Anyone who wants to come to Him must believe that God exists and that He is a rewarder of those that sincerely or diligently seek Him." So let's go back to Genesis, now chapter 39. It was not an accident that God steered the events for which Potiphar, of all people, purchased Joseph, a slave. Potiphar, being a captain of the guard with high responsibility. Chapter 39, verse 1, "And when Joseph was taken into Egypt by the Ishmaelite traders, he was purchased by Potiphar, an Egyptian officer, captain of the guard for the king of Egypt. The Lord was with Joseph, so he succeeded in everything as he served in the home of the Egyptian master." Somebody could argue, that can't be right. He can't be with Joseph. Because, I mean, Joseph is a slave, right? So when you're cursed to be a slave, then God's no longer in the picture. Oh, if it said that Joseph was suddenly rich, well, then I could see God right there at his right hand. But how can this be? It can be, and it oftentimes is, that even when we're walking the face of adversity, it would be a false premise to think, I guess I'm abandoned by God, I'm all alone out here. No, that wasn't the case. And especially in Joseph's situation, it says in verse 2, "And the Lord was with Joseph," was with Joseph. And as a result, and this is sooner or later the case with all of us, as often as water, as often as it's 32 degrees outside, water turns to ice. As often as one pursues a relationship with God, sooner or later the blessings do come forth. You know, we reap what we sow. So the Lord was with Joseph. He succeeded in everything as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. Potiphar noticed this and realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything that he did. It was similar to Jacob, who was working with his brother-in-law, Laban. And Laban really had not prospered at all. But when Jacob worked for him all those years for the two daughters, Laban understood and saw his bottom line increase. He saw himself, his cattle multiply. He saw the fact that when Jacob was with him, he didn't treat Jacob very well, but the fact that Jacob was there meant that Jacob's God was in the picture, and Laban was blessed. Reminds me back when we first started a church in Ocala at the Howard Johnson Inn, run by a group of a family from the nation of India. They came up to some of the brethren and people there about a year and a half into our lease, and they said, "We want you to stay here forever, because we know that because you're here, our business has doubled, and we don't want you to leave. So we're not going to change the price. We'll always let you have a key. We'll do whatever we can to make you happy." It's interesting, once in a while, people will notice that. I think Potiphar probably did too. When he looked and sized up this new slave, he thought, you know, he doesn't have, he's not a huge person, he doesn't have unlimited muscles, so can't really expect him to do a huge amount of grunt work. He doesn't know Egyptian. He's never been, looks like he's never been away from home. And he's 17, but there's something about him. I can't put my finger on it. There's something about him. Sometimes people have said that about some of you at work. You didn't curse, you didn't swear, you didn't try to ingratiate yourself with everybody, doing the things that other people often do. They notice you weren't griping about one's job. There's something different. What is it? They may not be able to put it together, but they know. decide, well, maybe the Lord is with those people, with you? That's a good question to ask. Is God with me? Is He with you? Is that something that you know is true, or that you hope is true, or you're not sure is true? It goes back to what kind of investment are we giving to our relationship with God? At any age, you could be 4 years old, you could be 34 years of age, or 114. God is not a respecter of persons in that way. You can be of any background, any age, whatever, and you can make a relationship for God work with you because He wants to respond. The next time you walk down the corridors of your high school, are you going far away to the feast and you need God's blessing of protection and help? Or when you're searching for work, is God sort of with you, or is He, you know He's with you? Not because you're perfect or I'm perfect. We know that He can be with us because we know what the relationship is all about. And we take the time to pray and to study. We take the time to make that relationship work in our lives. There are times when we need God when we need Him. And He'll respond when the time is right. His timing is impeccable. Impeccable. I remember when I was in the Ambassador College, I had the opportunity one summer to help out in the local church congregation in Las Vegas. I'd never been there in my life. Almost afraid to tell the people, my conservative friends in New Hampshire and Vermont, that I was in Las Vegas, because then they would have figured I had gone off the deep end for sure. I hunted for a job. I needed a job desperately, and otherwise I couldn't go back to school. It was a bad recession year when I was looking, and the odds of getting summer work that was part-time, I mean full 40 hours a week, but just for the summer, was almost impossible. And I wasn't in the union. So all of that was against me. And I hunted and I hunted, and I finally got a job. I didn't want to tell anybody because it wasn't that glamorous. It was at a restaurant. I worked at the Humpty Dumpty restaurant. It's a true name. And the reason I was there, I noticed that the cashier was very edgy when I was around the cash register. And she was always trying to send me in the back room. Oh, you know, you need to go see what the cooks are doing. You need to see how they ice those cakes. Really interesting, great work they do. Anything to get me out of there. But then when I'd look and there's nothing going on, I'd come back and she'd be at the register. She'd slam it shut, and she'd be upset that I was there. And I didn't understand. I was a bit naive. Finally, one day, this went on, and she waited till the height of the rush hour lunch, and she walked away from the job. Then the boss came out, and he says, well, you'll find me a lot easier to get along with. We had to get this woman to quit. She was stealing us blind, and she was taking all this money out of the cash register, but she was in the union, and it would cost us a lot more money to fight this, uphold the firing, than to induce the circumstances for her to want to leave, even if she's doing it out of spite. So I realized that every time I came back too early from the back room, I'd agitated her because she wasn't able to steal anything that day. And so then the boss said something else that was really overwhelmingly nice. He said, you know we didn't need you, Brad. We didn't need you. You just a, you know, babysit her to keep her from stealing from us. We knew we'd come out ahead. So here it was. I needed a job in this very secular town, and there was none to be had. And then I found the one job that I did find. They didn't need me, but I worked there anyway. And just in case I might get vain about it, it was at the Humpty Dumpty, and so there wasn't anything to talk about. It provided me just what I needed to get back on campus a few months later. Sometimes God will give you just what you need. I had to work and pound the pavement and pray as if it all depended on me. But if it wasn't for His sake, I might still be looking out there. And we all have various needs like that. And we can't allow obstacles and negativity to daunt us when people like Joseph have proven that God's way always works. It always works. Potiphar learned to trust Joseph implicitly. And I'm not insinuating that we should settle for work that's marginal and minimal. But sometimes those things are stepping stones to other things. Verse 2, and the Lord was with Joseph. He succeeded in everything as he served in the home of the Egyptian master. And Potiphar noticed that. I've read that. Verse 4, this pleased Potiphar, all of Joseph's success, because that made Potiphar successful. And soon he made Joseph his personal attendant. He put him in charge of his entire household. This could have been hundreds of servants for all we know. And everything that Potiphar owned, from the day that Joseph was put in charge of his master's household and property, the Lord began to bless Potiphar's household for Joseph's sake. All of his household affairs ran smoothly, and his crops and his livestock flourished. So Potiphar gave Joseph complete administrative responsibility over everything that he owned. And with Joseph there, Potiphar didn't have to worry about a thing, except just maybe what he would eat. Well, that didn't happen overnight, but it did happen quickly. I'm not exactly sure what led to what. It could have been that Joseph would notice, well, he obviously noticed everything around him. He might have gone up to Potiphar and said, "Sir, could we save on the animal feed by buying animal food that's from less expensive sources? I know of three better options already on that." Or Potiphar, "I noticed that can't help but notice your chariot. You need some grease on that wheel, and we need to change out some of the spokes on the wheel before it collapses on you." "Oh, that's right. I've been so busy with the court and everything with Pharaoh, I keep forgetting about that." "That's right. Yeah. Can you take care of that?" "Next day, I noticed that the Ethiopian slaves work better when they're together." "Really?" "Yeah. We can get more done." "Sir, I also would like to suggest that we bring in irrigation, and by my estimates, I think we can quadruple our crops. And that would make them maybe 10 times more valuable on the market." "Wow. You think that's right? I've seen that done. I've talked to other people." "Not only that, by the time the harvest season comes, I happen to know from other things and talking to people that there will be an influx of cattle for sale. Price will be down. You'd have be in a position to make 10 times as much on the crops, turn around and buy all this cattle for a smaller amounts of money, and you probably get ahead." Another day. "Sir, I noticed that new barn that you're planning to build is going to call for a lot of wood. But I've done the math, and I can show you here that we could save $150,000 if we use adobe bricks instead of a complete wood frame as the architects have drawn up. After all, we've, wood comes from afar and it's difficult. As you can see, reading between the lines, Potiphar had ideas, he had insight, he talked about faith and works, he needed God to bless him, yes. But he was not lazy. He was always thinking, working, helping, doing, innovating, creating, adding things up. And he became the CPA of the enterprise. Potiphar trusted him. He was good. His information was correct. And the bottom line kept improving. So perhaps Potiphar praised him to other men on the court. "I've got a guy back there that makes my life so much easier." So let's continue here in chapter 39. Because now it looks like things are going so well for Joseph. He doesn't have his father. He doesn't know where his brothers are. He's been left to hang out to dry. But things are going well. And it could be that he was starting to be remunerated monetarily for his great ideas. It says Joseph was very handsome and a well-built young man. Verse 7, and Potiphar's wife soon began to look at him lustfully, and she demanded that he come to bed with her. Joseph refused. Verse 8, he said, "Look, my master trusts me with everything in his entire house. No one here has more authority than I do. And he has held back nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How could I do this wicked thing? It would be a sin against God. He called it for what it was. In fact, verses like this help us to be able to substantiate the fact that God's Ten Commandments were in force even before they were reinstituted and given to at Mount Sinai to ancient Israel. But she kept coming after him. In verse 10, she kept putting pressure on Joseph day after day. Sometimes sin is like that. The sin that's all sin is dangerous. Some sin can sneak up on us, and we have to be aware of that. And then there are other times when there are things that are negative, that are tempting, that are blatant, they're out there, and they are so accessible, and it's day after day that they are constantly there. Now, Joseph refused to be with her. He kept out of her way as much as possible. Verse 11, but one day, however, when no one else was around, and when he went in to do his work, she came and grabbed some of the clothing on him, repeating her demands, and he tore himself away. The biggest, I think, reason that he was able to say no was that he had said no in advance. He had programmed himself on what to do in advance. It would have been maybe a lot more difficult if he were to say, well, let's think about this. Because the Bible says not to do that, because that leads to different wrong behavior. Why, here I am, he could say. I'm without my family. You know, it's hard being young, healthy, and single. If I quit maintaining my contact with God, I bet I could soon feel that even God abandoned me. So maybe in my situation, this is okay. Besides, maybe this is an open door for me to move myself up the corporate ladder. I mean, Potiphar's influential in the Pharaoh's court. He knows people. So probably she knows the same people. All she would have to do is say a right word to somebody, and those original dreams of mine could become a reality. Maybe this is God's way. All I have to do is, quote, help God out a little bit here. Now, Satan is the one that can provide endless rationalizations for improper behavior. And sure enough, he told himself things similar to that. You know, I should take over God's throne. I've served God for eons of years. Now it's my turn. A third of the angels already agree with me. Human beings should not have to rule over us, since we know so much more than they do. We've been around for a lot longer. No, I think we here in this room know that wrong is wrong. And even if we were to do wrong for, quote, the right reasons, that's just human nature. The way of that seemeth right that leads only to death. Let's not kid ourselves. We can't make the wrong way work. It'd be as erroneous as thinking, well, if I steal money and I tithe on it, then I'm okay. No, that doesn't work. Narrow is the way. Matthew 7:15. Narrow is the way, and few there be that walk in it. Well, most people are not sold on the fact that truth and the relationship with God is what is most significant. But it's God's way always works. And Joseph had worked his way in. And a lot of people, I'm amazed, when you see the history of Joseph, and the fact that eventually he became so valuable to the nation of Egypt under Pharaoh. He has a history of taking difficult situations and turning them into positives. You know, some people would say, "Oh, I'm just surrounded by lemons, and I there's no way out here. This is just, you know, I've been sold into slavery, and I'm just getting out of it, and now Potiphar's wife is destroying everything that I worked for." So, to continue this, Potiphar kept insisting. In verse 13, when she saw that she was holding the clothes that he was wearing when he had fled from her, she called out to the servants. At this point, she had determined that he was never going to have a relationship with her. And so out of anger and spite, she said, "Look, my husband has brought this Hebrew slave in here to make fools of us. He came into my room and he raped me, and I screamed. And when he heard my scream, he ran out and outside and got away. But he left this cloak with him, behind with me." So she showed it to her husband, and she told him the story. That Hebrew slave that you brought into our house tried to come in and molest me, she said. "And when I screamed, he ran out, leaving this with me." It says, Potiphar was furious when he heard his wife's story about how Joseph had treated her. I don't know if he was furious with Joseph or with his wife. Maybe with Joseph. Or maybe he didn't have much of a marriage. Maybe he thought, you know what? She's just made my life difficult for me. I have to save face. I have to banish Joseph, but I'm losing my right-hand man. I know that he didn't do this. I know that this couldn't have happened. That could have been how it played out. Regardless, the result was the same. Joseph was headed for prison. Not any prison, but where the king's prisoners were held, and there he remained. Verse 21, can anything good happen to somebody that has experienced such negativity? In verse 21, it says, but the Lord was with Joseph in the prison. In other words, something horrible could happen to somebody. But that doesn't mean, by itself, on its face, that God has abandoned the person or the situation. God might be carefully monitoring the situation. Okay, it's going to go on. It's going to go on. One more year or one more month. When the time is right, I'll take care of it. When the time is right, Joseph will be restored. But God was working with Joseph all the time. There was not one wasted day. Joseph was in this prison, but it wasn't just any prison. It was a prison where political prisoners were. And some of those people had been working for Pharaoh. They had high responsibility. They had above average intelligence. They were, if you think of Proverbs 22, verse 29, see a man diligent in his business, shall he not stand before kings instead of obscure people? That is a phenomenon in our society, any society, that those that are very good at what they do end up standing before the leadership of the world. And that was the way it was with some of the people that were thrown into this prison. Now, Joseph was lucky to be alive, and maybe that was the mercy of Potiphar, because normally a slave that would be indicted in court would be put to death for what allegedly Joseph had done. At any rate, Joseph was in this prison, and the Lord was with him in verse 21 and showed him favor. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. Before long, the warden put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and over everything that happened in the prison. Why? He must have been a master psychologist. Knew how to get along with everybody, say the right thing the right way. And by now, he was speaking fluent Egyptian. He had to, or he couldn't have done the things that he did for Potiphar. And he just had a knack of learning about circumstances and things. Here was his chance, with plenty of time on his hands, to interview all the people that worked for Pharaoh and worked for other people of prominence. Some were criminals, some maybe innocent. And able to find out, well, you know, what is it like at Pharaoh's court? Tell me, what's the minister of finance like? What's the minister of agriculture like? What do you think of these people? Well, let me tell you, And I was at the last party. This one guy made a fool of himself. He's arrogant. But this other person is very hardworking. And by the time, a couple years went by, Joseph knew all the makers, the players, and the shakers of Egypt in the court. He knew what to expect because the day was coming. He wasn't sure, but the day was going to come when he would stand in this very room, in front of all the leaders of that empire. And it would be his turn to speak, Joseph's turn. And he was learning about it. I have to believe that by the time he went in front of Pharaoh, He was comfortable. He was self-assured. Well, that way, yeah, self-assured, but with God's backing. And that he knew what the court looked like instead of being intimidated by it. Think of in the Sweet Adeline organization there. My wife never got to go to the nationals, the competition, the final, the final concert, because it was always on the Sabbath. But we'd hear stories where people that would go into international competition would practice and practice, and in their local area, and then the finalists would be in the final show, and it would be in some city in front of 10,000 people, and a number of these people had never been in front of more than 500 ever. And so when the curtain would draw, they'd go into sheer panic and freak out. That didn't happen with Joseph when he ultimately went in front of Pharaoh. But I'm getting ahead of it. Joseph was learning and working all the way through this. He was doing for the warden of the prison just what he did for Pharaoh. He learned along the way. And he developed his mental acumen, his abilities to put things together. And so it was in chapter 40 and verse 1. Sometime later, Pharaoh's cupbearer, or butler, and chief baker offended their royal master. Perhaps he thought that either one or both were trying to put him to death. Pharaoh became angry with the two officials, and he sent them to prison where Joseph was, in the palace of the captain of the guard. And they remained in prison for some time. And one of them, the butler, Joseph didn't know then, but God was sending the butler to be the guy that ultimately would get Joseph out of that prison. And so while they were there, those two had dreams. And they were troubled by them. And because there was plenty of time to talk, they ended up bringing this in front of Joseph. And Joseph said, well, the interpretation of dreams is God's business. But go ahead and tell me your dreams, and maybe God can help me to understand what they were. And after they did that, then Joseph told the butler, he said, in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to restore you to your original responsibilities. And when he does that, and you will be blessed, you must tell him to remember me. I have been here. I am innocent. I have been here under false accusation. And I need you to rectify my name and to help me out of this, since I'm giving you reassurance now. And then the baker was impressed and said, well, can you interpret my dream? And he told him something that probably raised the eyebrows of the butler. He said, my friend, in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to have you put to death because that's what your dream indicates. And that's what happened. Unfortunately, when the butler got out of prison, he totally forgot about Joseph. Maybe God inspired that to happen, because the time was not yet right. There's something about God's timing that's breathless sometimes. I mean, it can take your breath away. How accurate it is, how appropriate it is. So, at this point, then the butler said to Pharaoh said to his court, one day soon thereafter, I'm very, very troubled, gentlemen, and I need my wise counselors to help me out here. I had a dream last night that I saw seven healthy cows come out of the river Nile and grazing in the marsh grass, and then seven other cows came behind them. They were scrawny and thin, and they stood on the riverbank. And then the thin cows ate the seven healthy cows. And then I woke up. And then I dreamed the 7 ears of corn that were so healthy, and I was shocked that these sickly-looking ears came after them and ate them up. I know that this is significant. I think something's trying to tell me something. Gentlemen, you need to figure this out. I don't know what's going to happen, but something is important. This is different. I understand this. I feel and sense this. And they had no idea what to tell him. And they understood that if they didn't come up with an answer soon, he might say, well, why do I pay you to be my wise counselors? Maybe you need to be in that political prison. Maybe you need to be put to death. So it turned out that one of the butlers said, "Oh, I remember my faults this day. There is a Hebrew slave that was able to interpret our dreams. And he was able to do this for me and explain things, and it happened exactly the way he said it would. Is that right? Bring him. Bring him right now. We need him right now." The timing was right. Joseph was asked to wash himself. He was clothed in different clothing. And they didn't know, I'm sure Pharaoh didn't know what to expect. Hebrew slave, you know, shepherd. Shepherds aren't popular in Egypt. He's going to come. What if it's Earl Pitt? Somebody, "Well, sure, I can interpret dreams." You know, something like that. Well, then they throw him out. But he came in. He was full of poise. Spoke fluent Egyptian. Why, he wasn't like the other prisoners. He was self-assured. There was something about him. There was just something, the way he carried himself. After all, though, God was with him. Wasn't that old, maybe about 30 years of age. And yet, they were amazed when he began to take command of the courtroom. He said, "There is a God in heaven that understands and can interpret dreams. And tell me what you dreamed, and let's see if he can help me." So Pharaoh repeated the dream. And without hesitation, he says, "Here is what God has said to Pharaoh. There will be 7 years of plenty, and then there will be 7 years of famine. You have a choice. You can allow this country, this empire, to crash, to die, to become extinct as it starves to death. Or you can plan for the future, not only survive, be a blessing for the rest of the world, and increase your stature and your influence around the world, and have a greater control over a lot of the economy of the world." Wow, you know, this is incredible. "Well, Hebrew, what do you suggest we do?" It was like, well, he's got the answers this far. We might as well see what else he has to say to us. And without any hesitation, he says, "You need to have people appointed to plan for this. Build barns, have storage houses, cultivate, irrigate, take advantage of these different crops, these bumper crops. Not waste a thing. Plan for the future. Know that it will, that when the difficult times come, people are going to be moving here. They need housing, they need everything. They need water, they need facilities, they'll need food. We have to provide these things. We have to think ahead. We're going to see huge shifts in the population. And so we've got to be ready for that. So there's plenty to do if we're not raising crops. We've got to store them, harvest them, build the silos, etc." So he was rattling this all off, or something, you know, to this extent, even though it's not all spelled out here. But it had to be more of a conversation, because when it was all said and done, and he not only said that, I forgot. He said, "And then we need to have a system of place, because they'll be wanting to sell themselves as slaves when the money runs out. And you'll be in a position to not only help them, but to prosper in the process." And everything Joseph touched turned to gold. Pharaoh was impressed. Why, he's got the solution to my dilemma. Not only does he answer dreams, he knows how to turn things around. He's a turnaround artist. He can get us through this dire time. He's going to save us, the world, and keep our prominence. And so he looks at him and he says, "Well, who is it that we could appoint to do this great work? Why, there's nobody else that seems to understand this, and yet you know it precisely." And he says, "You're in charge of the entire country. The only other person that's higher is myself." Now, there were a dynasty of Egyptians during this period of time that were from outside of Egypt. So the concept of an alien person, a non-Egyptian, being in prominence was not a strange idea. But here, all of the hard work, the vision was paying off. Joseph could have compromised along the way. He could have caved in to Potiphar's wife situation. But he might have said, "You know what? If I do this, then how many other things will I have to do to maintain this tenuous relationship? How many times will I have to hide? And if she asked me to do other things that I knew were wrong, then she could hold this blackmail over me." Ah, but you compromised here. Shall I let everybody know? He might have thought, you know, if I compromise, I will go to jail. And if I don't, I may go to jail. But the bottom line is, sin is not worth it. I can't expect to live the wrong way and expect good things to happen. It says in 1 Thessalonians 5, 21 and 22, prove all things, hold fast to that which is good, and abstain from all evil. Proverbs 15, verse 3, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the good and the evil, and God would know, even if nobody else did. Some things are difficult, and while others are saying it ain't fair, there are those that agree with the Apostle Paul, 2 Corinthians 4:17. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works in us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So when it says, count it joy, if we see some adversity, some trials, whether it be health or anything else, what does that mean? That do we get discouraged? No. That we think and ask WWJD, what would Joseph do? He was undaunted. Now, when we talk about counting it joy for trials, I'm not saying that if we go to the hospital, we say, hooray, this is the thing I've been waiting for. I think this is joyous. Or, oh, I had just had a huge traffic accident. This is wonderful. No, it's not wonderful. I've never seen anybody really rejoice in adversity like that. But if we consider the fact that that is an obstacle that we can hurdle and get over with God's help, and that by doing so it makes us stronger, we can count that as contributing to the inner joy that we can have when we feel better about our end result, feel better that we've survived the adversity, that we have survived like Joseph survived. It's an interesting study, as I draw this to conclusion here. There was a study made one time of the 300 most influential people in the world. It turned out that 1 out of 4 had a serious handicap. And 3 out of 4 were born into poverty or dysfunctional family adversity. People like Louis Pasteur had terrible health issues. The historian Francis Parkman, he could only work 5 minutes at a time. Then he'd have to rest. Then he'd go back to work for 5 more minutes. And he cranked out 20 huge volumes of history, world history. Bunyan, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, he did it from jail. The Apostle Paul wrote many of his epistles from jail. Somebody wrote one time, life is 10% what happens and 90% how we react to that. God evaluates that. Joseph, after his earliest mistakes, was marvelous, and through the Red Seas of trouble, was able to always land on his feet and to make things work out for the good. Maury Wills, who was the shortstop for the Los Angeles Dodgers, led the league and set a record in his career of stealing the most bases of anybody. He'd hit the magic number of 100 bases. You may not care about baseball, but that's quite a feat. And when people said, well, how do you do it? How is it possible? You just seem to have a lot of luck. He says, well, if there's good luck involved, I define luck as preparation meeting opportunity. When you prepare yourself, and I say this to people of any age, when you learn things, develop, and guess what? The average person, you know how much of their brain the average person uses? 50%, 60%, 3%. Einstein used, they think, 10%. But when people are active, they're not watching TV all the time, and they're not wasting their time chattering away in mindless things. When they're learning and developing, they use that. They can accomplish a lot of things. And that's what Joseph certainly did. He never was idle with his time. Always seeing possibilities, changing, learning skills, learning a language, learning how things worked, and learning them, mastering them, and becoming so knowledgeable that he could make contributions. It's a phenomenal example of a person that stayed the course at a young age, and that carried him. You know, he was prominent in the leadership of Egypt for about 80 years. I don't think any other leader would ever remotely come close. Haile Selassie might have gone 50 plus years, but there are very few examples of royalty having that kind of lineage. 50 years or so for the king of Thailand. But Joseph was extraordinary. He had a relationship with God. He was undaunted. He did the right things all the time. He was close to God. To make that happen, God was always with him. If you want, and if I want God to be with me as I walk the corridors of my school, or at my workplace, or with other people, or here, or anywhere else, then I have to make that relationship happen. I have to open up God into my life and make time for Him. He's got to be number one. And if I can do that, then He can help me with the things that I need, or you with the things that you need and want. Everybody here should be a thriving success. We live in that land of opportunity anyway. But aside from that, and even if we didn't, God's way works. Joseph was able to do it under every kind of adversity. And instead of saying, it ain't fair, he said, I will make it work. And it will be more than fair. So as we live our lives, as we go on, I think it's occasionally valuable for us to ask, WWJD.